So before getting to the reading, I want to thank you so much for inviting us as a family here. It's a real pleasure. And just to continue a little bit about my story very briefly, so I don't bore you, and I don't get center stage instead of the Word of God. My journey started in 1991 with a Bible that I saw lying on the street, because that's when the missionaries first came to Albania and they distributed Bibles. And people would just throw them away afterwards. I found one on the street, I read it, I didn't understand much. I went to an Orthodox church eventually, which was the only Christian church in town. No one could explain to me what the Bible was about. The priest himself came from communism, had no idea. So I ended up for a while going to the mosque, so I became a Muslim. I thought Islam was the only way to God at that point. I also became a Muslim student at a school preparing future preachers. I actually made a lot of progress. I learned some of the Quran, the holy book of Islam, by heart. I was making good progress, as Paul says, and then Christ got a grab on me, and he saved me. It's a long story, but it happened through a missionary who spoke to me about Jesus. I already knew about the Bible, but I didn't know the Jesus of the Bible at that point. So when he spoke to me, it was as if the Bible came alive. And I came to Christ, and as I decided, what should I do now? It was a Muslim high school. Should I go back, or should I go to a public high school and finish my education there? And the Lord gave me a strong verse at that point saying, you need to go back. It is that verse from Paul in the book of Acts when it tells the Ephesian elders, for 3 years I have given you the counsel of God. And in Greek, in English it's translated a bit differently, he says, so my hands are clean from your blood. And the Lord basically gave me this message. If you leave, they'll probably never hear about Christ again. Their blood will be on your hands. It was like a hammer to my brain. I didn't want to go back. I was the best Muslim student. So how would I face them again and tell them about a different religion altogether? But I did go there. It was the hardest and best year of my life. I evangelized all of my friends. And I was eventually found out and kicked out of that school. But I did enjoy that year. And then I completed my education elsewhere. As a Christian, I knew that I just wanted to serve the Lord. You can imagine, Albania has always been poor, but especially at that point, it was poor and there were even fewer Christians. And I just wanted to serve the Lord. So at the university, I founded a Christian organization, which later became part of the UCCF here. That's what you call it here. And I've been working with them ever since. But also, I worked with a few churches in pastoral positions for a while. And I've translated as many books as I can, because in Albania, unlike you, where you have wonderful books galore, we don't. There is a lot of need for that. So I translated books as well as I've written some of my own. I go back to the earliest period of the Christian church, and I translate the earliest Christian so-called church fathers. They don't belong to the Catholics or to the Orthodox. They belong to all of us. So I've done that in Albanian. And so the Lord brought us here. It's been a long, long ride. I finished a master's degree at Cambridge some years ago. And then we came over to Edinburgh eventually, where I just finished my PhD in the area of earliest Christianity. I study the documents that we now read in English, in Greek, in there basically the earliest form, written in those ancient, beautiful manuscripts. Because as a former Muslim, one of my questions has always been, how do we know that the Bible we have today has not been corrupted, but it is the same thing that was written, say, in the first century by Jesus' own friends and followers? So that's been one of my driving reasons for doing this. It's not an intellectual pursuit for its own sake. In Albania, no one gets rich by studying theology. But I also know that this is the call that God has given me in my life. And my wife is a pastor's daughter, which is so rare. In Albania, most of us are first-generation Christians. So her name is Alta. I think some of you Mehta. And she's also been involved with church ministry as we were doing different kinds of jobs to survive and also, you know, do some ministry as much as we could. Okay, so just to get into the sermon today, it's going to be from the first letter of Peter. Apparently, it was written sometime near the end of Peter's life. And it is the question there, the driving question for Peter is, how do I encourage a group of people who are spread out, they're followers of Jesus, mainly spread out in what is today's Turkey, but who are suffering for being Christian? Now, looking around the room here, I know that many and probably most of you know about suffering much more than I do. You know exactly what it means to suffer because you've done it for quite a while. And for Peter's audience, it was a difficult life because they were suffering just for the fact that they were Christian. Now, it wasn't an easy life to live for them, as it was, because most of them would have been slaves. Imagine, back in the first century, even when you were rich, it wasn't exactly like a great life compared to what it is today. But for them, who were slaves, poor people, under somebody else's household and bidding, it was a very difficult life to live as it was. Then when you became a Christian, you became a rebel. You didn't want to become one. But when you became a Christian, you said, by saying the Lord is Christ, you are saying that Caesar was not. By saying that the Lord is Christ, you are saying that all of the gods in whom all of your friends, family, relatives, your masters believed, all of those gods were nothing. Christ was never one for pluralism. When you embraced him, you risked life and limb at that time. You were cancelled, not like you are today on Twitter, on Facebook, on social media, which is, of course, not easy because, as we know, many Christians to this day, today, might lose their jobs, their livelihoods, simply for being Christian. Imagine how hard that was for them. So Peter wants to write to them about suffering. How do we cope with suffering for being Christian? You know what it is like, because you've all worked, you've all studied, and you have friends, and you feel a criminal simply for expressing a belief in which most of the people around you don't believe anymore. And even though you do that with love, you're still considered somebody who is bigoted. You're a bigot. And it's not easy. I mean, now in this church, it's easier said than done to say we're all Christians, we can all stand together. But when you're out there, it's anything but easy. So Peter is telling them how to live amidst suffering as Christians. And I want us to look today at a particular passage. It's a brief one, but it's situated at the very end of Peter's First Peter's as a letter. And this is chapter 5, verses. I want to read from the end of verse 5 till verse 9. We'll focus more on two verses. All of you clothed, sorry, let me repeat once again. So, 1 Peter 5, verses 5 to 9. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another, because God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith, because you know that the family of believers throughout the world is undergoing the same kind of sufferings. What Peter is saying here is that there is an antidote to suffering. That's what we're looking at today, verses 6 and 7. There is an antidote to suffering as a Christian. We shall look at four things that Peter is clearly setting out. And it is what this antidote is, what it does, what it looks like, and why it works. First of all, what is this antidote to suffering? Now, when I was a kid, at some point I was about 14, I think, so that was 10 years ago. Together with a friend of mine, we set out to go to a mountaintop, which was located near my town. And we didn't know how to get there, to be honest with you. This was Albania pre-anything, even pre-books in a sense, let alone internet. So we didn't know how long it would take us or whether we could make it. We thought it was just a mountaintop and that's it. It took us quite a few hours to get to that top over there. And it was very difficult, very precarious. We had the wrong kind of shoes. We were ill-prepared and ill-equipped for that. But then we made it, and then we saw, instead of hoping to see the sea, we actually saw another mountaintop. We had not been prepared that there was a range. And then we go over the second mountaintop. You go down the valley, and it's so difficult because you thought you made it. Then you go down a few more hours, then you go up the mountaintop, and again, there is another mountaintop. And you have to go down the valley again, repeatedly, without knowing when it will stop. And that's exactly, in a sense, what Christian life is all about. You have to go down the valley to reach a mountaintop, which lasts for a while, which is great, and then you have to go down the valley of suffering again. So what is an antidote to suffering? And Peter says in verse 6, first of all, what it is humility. Verse 6, humble yourselves therefore under God's mighty hand. Now, as you can see here, it's a command, and it is a voluntary decision to humble yourselves. Now, as a Christian, in the first century, you were humbled enough by the circumstances around you. Whether you wanted it or not, you were looked at as the scum of the earth, as Paul says. You are nothing. But what Peter is saying is that when you suffer, instead of fighting back, as people are wont to do, you have to embrace that humility yourself. Embrace it as a status of humility before God. Intuitively, what we want to do when we suffer is, what do we do when we suffer? We have anxiety. And anxiety means it forces your brain to come up with a solution. It's natural. And then when you can't come up with a solution, you become even more anxious. And when you become anxious, you don't make the wisest of decisions often, because you want to survive. And Peter is saying, do a counterintuitive thing. Humble yourselves. Do the exact contrary of what the world is telling you to do. Humble yourselves in the hand of a mighty God, or under God's mighty hand. And we can see why that is. He does not say, give it up. You know that Stoicism is well, and alive today is... You may not have heard of the name, but you know exactly what it stands for. It means, or the Scots would certainly know, and so would the English, stiff upper lip. Just fake it till you make it. Do not complain. Accept life for what it is. Fight, even if you're dealt a losing hand, you still have to keep on fighting. Don't complain. But that's not what Peter is saying. He's saying, humble yourselves under God's mighty hand. When we fight because we feel hopeless and we think that there is nobody to help us. And as a Christian, we still think like in the old days, you know, we want to take life in our own hands and fight. But Peter is reminding us, when you humble yourselves, he's not saying humble yourselves to the hand of this blind fate of yours. No, he's saying, humble yourselves before God because he is mighty. Now, the expression mighty hand of God, do you know how many other times we find it in the New Testament? Never. This is the only time. But in the Old Testament, you see it so often, and Peter is trying to make a point there because he's writing to people who knew the Old Testament, who knew the scriptures of Israel. And that expression, the mighty hand of God, is used mostly in the setting of the Exodus. God keeps reminding his people, from the first five books of Moses until the end of the Old Testament, that I held you by my mighty hand and I took you out of Egypt and brought you to the land of promise. So this is not just an expression telling us who God is, which is of course true. It is an expression trying to remind us that we are the new Israel. And like Israel came out of Exodus because of God's mighty hand, as a slave people who were nothing, who had nothing. They took so many things from the Egyptians because of God. They made it through the desert, and the second generation made it into Israel because of God, not because of them. Peter is saying, you are foreigners, strangers, and he mentions that in his letter, because you're on, like exiles, you're on a path to returning or to going to the promised land. And this is not it. This is a walk of suffering, which might take a while, but it will certainly be finished one day, successfully, because just as God took a people, 2 million people, out of a place to another one, he's taken us to a destination to which we can never get on our own, but we will certainly make it. So humble yourselves in a tough situation where you know there is nothing you can do. Just place your life in the hands of God. This is what it is. The antidote to suffering is counterintuitive. It is basically humble. Accept your humble status. It is easier said than done. But it is what it is. It is the only antidote that works. So, the antidote is humility. But what does it do? That he may lift you up in due time. Now, again, you know, it is again difficult to accept within yourself the fact that the only way that I can reach the top is on my knees. That's the hardest lesson that I'm keeping on learning in my own life, that we're all learning. To get to the top, you just go down on your knees before God, that he may lift you up in due time. What it does, it exalts you. This antidote will bring exaltation. But it is a condition. It doesn't say he will do this. He says, do this so the Lord may lift you up. God causes us, our character, to grow as we suffer. It's never fun. It's never nice. It was never meant to be at the beginning. But now it is a fact of life. And we as Christians are not called away from suffering. All we're called to do is to live in suffering in such a way that it shows people that only God can do this. Only God can bring meaning to suffering and use it for his glory. That he may lift you up in due time. In the Old Testament, again, Peter knew his Old Testament. He was not well schooled, but he knew the Word of God. And lifting you up is a theme all over the Psalms. And basically, you can see it in different ways. One way is, it was meant as a way to honor you. So when a person who believed in the Lord was suffering, God at the end brought honor. People saw that actually God had not forsaken Job or David. Suffering is not because you have sinned. Suffering is often despite because of your life. And God gives you exaltation. Or another way it's used in the book of Psalms is he brings relief. Somebody was suffering either because of his friends, either because of everyone like Saul wanting to kill David, or because David or the psalmist was sick, deadly sick, at death's door, and God brought relief. He lifted you up out of the mire, out of the gates of Sheol. So it is honor, it is relief, and it is vindication. People who hate you today because you're a Christian, you're someone of no name, of no import, God gives you relief, and then people see that person belongs to God. He will lift you up. But to get to the crown, you have to go through the cross. When you read the first letter of Peter, three or four times he mentions the example of Jesus intentionally. Because what he's trying to tell them and us is, if Christ suffered, so shall we. And because Christ made it, so will we. But Christ only made it because he had to suffer. He had to go to the cross and he got the crown. Now he's exalted high, Peter says. He's above all angels, above all powers. To get to the end of your journey successfully, you have to face suffering. We have to keep on saying that, because while much of the generation here is used to this lesson, most of my generation is not. We are used to the so-called entitlement. You're entitled to have a good life, even though you stand on the blood of so many good people in the First World War and earlier. Democracy can certainly die. You're not entitled to anything. You thank God for all your privileges, but you need to learn to suffer in order to get somewhere and build something for those behind you. So he will certainly lift you up in due time. That means he will do that in God at God o'clock. There is a time that you will certainly see God's good hand on your life and you'll think, I see it. You have a eureka moment at that point. I see it. And you're ready to face the other mountaintop. But that will happen in God's good time. And that's a lesson we are learning as a family right now. I want certain things at a certain point in time because I can see the walls closing in on me, on my family, financially, in terms of the future. And then you feel like, when, Lord? And he says, at God o'clock, I'll do it. I'm not playing games with you. People sometimes treat God as if he plays games with us. He's just trying, like Satan, to play tricks to see whether we can make it or not. God is not like that. But God is like a good father who knows exactly the end before it begins. But a good father with a small child, he cannot tell him or her everything because they will not understand. All he requires of them is suffer for a little while. Trust me, if you keep on learning the alphabet, one day you'll become a doctor. When, Daddy? Next week? You get that question? No, but you'll eventually get there. At God o'clock, he will lift us up. But we need the cross before the crown. We need to go through that. It's always painful, but it is always rewarding. And then, so we know what it is. It is an antidote to suffering is humility. We know what it does. It brings exaltation in God's due time, in his season. And thirdly, in verse 7, cast all your anxiety on him. So what does this antidote look like? Now, even though all of us here have read the New Testament, we know the story, and we're familiar with the letters, remember that certain things are and look quite counterintuitive, again, in what Peter is saying. What do I mean by that? When you say the antidote is humility, and then you want to explain what humility looks like, you don't expect him to continue by saying, cast all your anxiety on him. You think it looks like this. Humility looks like patient endurance under trial. That's the first thing that comes to mind. So humble yourselves mean be patient in your suffering. But actually, what Peter says here is something that does not at first on the surface looks well connected. Humility for him looks like casting your anxiety on the Lord. All of it. He's quoting from the book of Psalms, which again, can you see like every single sentence is filled with Old Testament quotations, or he's trying to remind us of the Old Testament. Because, brothers and sisters, this church is wonderful, and it's somewhat old, but it is part of a long, long line of believers, which goes back to the beginning of time. It's amazing. The Old Testament is not just a story that we tell ourselves. We are part of that story. This is where it all began. And in that story, one of the Psalms says, cast your worries on the Lord. Now, What Peter is saying is this. Worry is sin. Worry is pride. That's why humility looks like casting all of your worries on Him. Because when you worry, you, as you well know, as I will too well know, unfortunately, in my own life, is I always catch myself thinking, why am I worrying? And we know why. Because we think that God is either too small, too weak, or too big for our worries. And we think we need to do all of the worrying for ourselves. Now, thankfully, Peter is not saying something like, stop worrying. That's what humility looks like. He doesn't say that. He says, just cast all your anxiety on Him. And he adds the word all intentionally. Because like I said, when we worry, we think, I'm worried, but look at my brother who's suffering so much more than I do. How can I dare bring my worry to God? I need to do something about it myself. God is too big for this little worry of mine. Or, like I said, God is too small. We don't say it, but we do live it that way. Sometimes we think, well, you know, it's just probably too much for God. Otherwise, He would have answered my situation. He would have answered my prayer in this suffering. He hasn't. Therefore, what do I do? Automatically, I treat God as if He is weak. Or at other times, you know what it is like. When you're suffering, and it's the same type of suffering, it's the same type of worry. And you cast your burden on the Lord. And then what happens is afterwards, what do? An hour later, even 5 minutes later, you find yourself going to the cross again and casting it all over again at His feet. And you feel like you're a traitor to God's cause. I'm not doing Him honor. Therefore, I stop bringing it before God. God is saying through Peter, cast all your worries, all of it, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It is big to you. The fact that it is causing you to stumble, the fact that it is causing you to have pain in your life, anxiety, it is important enough for God. And it is never too big or too small for Him. So just cast it on Him. That expression is used, if you remember, I think a few times in the New Testament, but particularly when the disciples took all their cloaks and cast it on the donkey, they gave it to Jesus to sit upon and enter Jerusalem. Just take it away from you and cast it before the Lord. It creeps back to you as an old ragged cloth, but you still have to take it out again and give it to Him. That's what it looks like, humility. Throwing your worries on Him constantly, the whole time. God doesn't mind because He knows what you're going through. He doesn't tell us to stop worrying. He does tell us to continually cast all our worries on Him. All of it. Now, we saw that it is, this antidote is humility. It's such a vial that we've seen before, but it is there and it is the only thing that saves us. Have you noticed often in your own life, when you're particularly sick in your body, like the back, and you got an issue, there are certain medicines that are not taken as pills. That's what we wish. Just give me a pill, doctor. But the doctor says, look, there is an old way, well and tried, and that's physical exercise. This is what you need to do. Now tell me, is it easier to exercise every single day or take a pill once a day? And we know that the only way to get better is through physical exercise, and we still find it so hard to do. It is our only way to get well. And it is the same thing with humility. We have to keep on doing it. That's the only antidote. As difficult as it sounds, it works. And what it does, it brings exaltation. And what it looks like casting all your anxiety on Him. Okay, but the final question then that Peter is trying to answer for all of us is, and it is the most important, why does it work? Why does this work? I said that Peter was quoting from a well-known verse in the book of Psalms, in chapter 55, verse 22. And Peter cuts it in half, though. Because the psalm says, "Cast your anxiety on the Lord," and then continues, "and He will sustain you. He will not permit the righteous to be moved." Now, that thought is certainly in Peter's mind, but he doesn't finish the thought that way. He cuts it off. Instead of saying what the Lord will do, he tells us why He does it, why this medicine works. Because He cares for you. Now, okay, think with me for a little bit. When you read that verse, don't you want it to say, "because He loves you"? And it is true. God loves us. He says it so throughout the New Testament and the Old as well. But He says He cares for you. It looks like something that is so, how to put it, underwhelming. But it is overwhelming when you think about it. Because when we suffer, what happens is that we are afraid that God doesn't care. Practically, you feel in all of your anxieties when they're unsolved, God doesn't care. Well, He does care. And that's what He's telling us here. And Peter is probably thinking of one specific case in Jesus' life. He was there with the other disciples on a boat which was about to go down. Jesus was sleeping, and he said, and Peter and the others went to Jesus and said, "Lord, Master, don't you care that we are drowning?" That's the exact same word that Peter uses here. Mark uses it too. And Mark, they say, took it from Peter's sermons. "Don't you care that we are drowning?" "Well, don't you care that I'm drowning, Lord?" And Peter says, "He does care." Why do we know that? This question is worthwhile if you ask it to any other religion, including my former religion, Islam. How do we know that God cares, but not about Christianity? We know He does care, because He sent His own Son to come down, live like we did, go through the same sufferings, and worse, go to the cross for us, and die for us. So does He care? 100%. God cares enough to come down here Himself and solve the mess in which we found ourselves in. If He came down here to change the history of the world 2,000 years ago, and we are a continuation of that story, we're in good hands, brothers and sisters. God cares. God is not indifferent. Peter Hitchens, the famous atheist who has now gone to see the Lord, unfortunately, he died a few years ago of cancer. He said once, he got cancer, and then by the end of his life, he wrote an article. You may have heard of it. And he said in that famous article, "To my dumb question, why me? The universe barely bothers to respond. Why not?" Now, when we're a Christian, we don't think that way. Because we know that God is present. He exists. He's not like universe, which is something that has no sense and is also deaf, cannot hear your prayers. God is real. He is alive. And He came down on earth. He cares. He doesn't say, He barely bothers to respond, "Why not?" No. There is a rhyme and reason to suffering. And we might know what it is, but we know what it does. It brings exaltation. If we have humility, this antidote, this is what it is. It will bring the exaltation at God o'clock. And what it is like, it's basically just casting your anxieties time and time and again on Him. And finally, it works because God cares to the point of dying on that rugged cross for me and for you. And as much as a cliche as it sounds, it is true. It is historically true, and the fact that you and I are standing here today 2,000 years later is because it is true. It works, and no empire has stood up against it and succeeded. All the empires are going down. Yours, unfortunately, here too, in the UK, is certainly going down at some point. It will certainly get better before it get worse before it gets better, unfortunately for all of us. Hard times are coming, but God will certainly pull us all through together, all of us. And what we need to do, as Peter did, is just keep on encouraging one another. Why did Peter write this letter? Do you think that he had learned his lesson? To a certain degree, certainly. But he was not perfect. That's why, as you know, he had that foot-and-mouth disease. He was always saying the wrong thing. He was doing the wrong thing. At one point, he told Jesus, "Look, Lord, don't say you're going to die." So he was, just think about it. He was stopping the redemptive history of the world in its tracks by doing that. If Jesus didn't die, we would be the wretchedest of people today. But Peter learned his lesson by continually humbling himself before God, and he made it to the end. And so shall we, but we need to keep encouraging one another. This letter made it to this book, to this day, because people saw the power that it had of encouraging one another. Let's keep on doing that as long as it is day, brothers and sisters. Let us keep encouraging one another to humble ourselves before God and to keep reminding ourselves and each other that it works because God cares. Thank you.